like, so the individual henchmen, like, you know, the old crazy long-haired homeless guy and the assassin and the hammer girl and the baseball, those guys I take seriously as villains, but the guy on top, I just, you know, it's, and it's like, I don't know. It's like, what do you do? It's your son. You know, you got a bad, it's like, John Wick, you know, you had Theon Greyjoy as a son. You fucked up. You should have sent better sperm. You should have choose better eggs. It's out of your hands now. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another Bald Move Pulp podcast. This is a commission by Bald Move fan Ed. We'll be getting to his notes here in a minute. He wanted us to watch The Raid 2 Retaliation. Or The Raid 2. It's also called The Raid Retaliation. It's a 2014 Indonesian film directed by Gareth Evans, who I just today realized is not, in fact, Gareth Edwards as well. I thought this was like, it's like, oh, and then I was like, wait a second, these IMDb filmographies aren't adding up. Gareth Evans, Welsh filmmaker Gareth Evans, was also wrote, produced, and directed and edited these films, The Raid Redemption and The Raid Retaliation. He also did Merantu, which is his first kind of Indonesian martial arts film. The Apostle, starring Dan Stevens, which I quite enjoyed. That came out in 2018. It's like a horror film. It stars Iko Uwais, who was also in Merantu. It's his first film he did with Gareth. The Night Comes for Us, The Raid, the original Raid Redemption, as well as a Netflix series called Wu Assassins. It also stars Yahya Ruhian, who you might have seen in Star Wars The Force Awakens, or John Wick 3, or Boy Kills World. These are based on the Indonesian martial arts called Pencak Silat, which I've kind of become slowly familiar for. I guess it's the new Krav Maga, you know, the hot new stylish martial arts that you know, looks really good when you film it. And the other thing about this movie is I've heard about The Raid for like 10 years, and I remember a couple of years back I sat down to, I was like, oh my god, I'm trying to find The Raid, and being confused about, well, which is the first one? I was looking for The Raid, but I had Raid Redemption, Raid Retaliation. I'm like, where's the original? And I couldn't tell which was which. So I didn't end up watching it until, what was it, like over Christmas? It was sometime late winter.
Pretty recent, yeah.
It's within recent memory. And Ed emailed us and said, is there any way I could get a commission for The Raid and The Raid 2? And I'm like, no, it doesn't really work that way, but you're in luck. Because just like a week or two before he commissioned it, Jim and I had sat down to watch The Raid. So he's kind of getting a little bit of a lucky two for one here. Jim, do you want to talk about your thoughts, your relationship with The Raid? And I guess we're going to talk about The Raid series as a whole, but you know, this is primarily focused on The Raid 2. That's what we sat down to watch. Do you want to talk about your experience with The Raid series, in particular Raid 2?
Yeah, sure. I want to say that I first saw The Raid Redemption, it had to be at least a decade ago. Yeah, and I don't know. It was probably around the time that I moved out to Cincinnati. I had heard about it from some lunatic named Dave Lang. And a lot of people are probably laughing right now because they know who Dave Lang is. But he talked about it on one of his podcasts and said it was just this amazing, stylish action movie. This was back, you know, it wasn't released until 2012, so it couldn't have been too much more than a decade ago. And I remember sitting down to watch that and hearing the premise and then sitting down to watch it, and I was kind of blown away by it because it has a style of martial arts action cinematography that I think is not often employed, and it's employed extremely well here, which is just a lot of wide shots. Way more wide shots than you get from a lot of action films. And that gives it like this real feel to it, where you feel like you're kind of in the action and it doesn't feel fake. It feels like it's actually happening. So I was blown away by it. And that whole first movie of him, you know, just basically climbing a tower, beating the shit out of people, a la Dread or something, is kind of awesome.
Did you see this before you saw Dread?
Man, it was... No, I think I saw Dread first. But it couldn't have been by much.
I think that, like, before I'd seen this, you had introduced me to Tony Jaa, and, you know, this, he's a Thai martial artist, and there is definitely some similarities, because I think that, like, you know, you probably can explain the popularity of the raid and its notoriety, like, that he is one of the front runners of that, but... you know, and I can't speak of, like, my long history of it, because, like, you know, I heard about those films. I heard how influential they are to the, you know, the martial arts films and the action films of the 2010s. Like, you can see definitely you can see the blueprint from The Raid, the original, in Dredd. Like, Dredd is arguably a Judge Dredd reskin of The Raid.
They came out almost at the same time, though, is the weird thing. Same year.
The Raid came out a year earlier. So, like, I think that this is probably time to influence it. Or maybe they had the same ideas. Like, hey, we got to do a low budget thing. How do we do it? Make sure it's all set in, like, it's a bottle action episode. And it's all set in this one concrete block building. Yeah. You can definitely see the DNA and, like, John Wick. You know, like, it's, like, just incredibly influential. And, like, this is kind of the new hot martial arts. Like, there's this, it's what's, like, I guess the hallmarks of this this martial arts, this Pinchak Salat.
There's a hallmark for me, but I don't think it's a hallmark for the martial art. The hallmark for me is a lot of leg trauma. And not in, like, a manipulating of joints, but, like, a blades to the legs kind of way. That is the most horrific thing. The thing that stands out the most to me. As far as, like, movement goes, it feels like it's, you know, similar to what Tony Jaa does with in Ong Bak, with a lot of elbow strikes. A lot of very fast, flourishy kind of movement, but more constrained than something like a Jet Li, right? Jet Li's doing these flashy... You know, big, large moves. Here, it's a lot of short, concise, and fast movement. To me, that's kind of what it is. And then there's, like, ground game type stuff too.
That's the thing that, like, always strikes me about these Indonesian inspired kind of martial arts is the multi-stage, like, large joint destructions.
Sure.
Where you're catching a guy's arm and you bend it backwards and you take their wrist and everything snaps, or you like block their kick, but then you hook their leg and you spin around and then bend suddenly. Yeah, there goes their knee, then there goes their ankle. And it's like, you know, when you're playing, like, Batman Arkham Asylum and you build your combo meter enough for Batman to do his ultimate thing and he just, like, grab some criminal. Grabs his foot and, like, twists it the wrong way and then puts his weight. Like, it's like that, only there's three additional stages and these guys' combo meters are always full. They're just always able to completely ruin a person's mobility and or paralyze them in three moves or less. And it's both awesome and it also strikes me as funny.
Occasionally, yeah. There's some really funny, and honestly, like I said, with the blade trauma stuff, stuff I can't even really look at. It squicks me out too much.
Yeah, I will say that. So, I think this is one of the some of the toughest to watch violence. It almost borders on torture porn, and I'm not even talking about the cool action scenes. The way Gareth Evans likes to establish that a guy is scum is he likes to have him just brutalize usually a woman in some kind of scary sexual type of situation, or he will just, like, psycho serial kill somebody. And, like I said, it verges to the point of, like, the torture porn, like, horror films that I don't like. It didn't quite get there. But there, yeah, especially up until you get to the midpoint of the movie where it's still establishing people's stakes and which people are the bad people versus the real bad people.
Sure.
Borderline excessive. I could have maybe used a little less of the sadistic violence.
I guess this is as good a time as any then to say, what did you think of the movie overall, The Raid 2?
I was blown away by The Raid. I thought that movie was incredible. Oh, it's another, like, if you've seen Daredevil, like, it's heavily influenced by this movie. All of the combat, some of the scenes in this, especially. I really liked The Raid. I thought it was, you know, a pretty brainless action flick that had just next level action, just and really interesting. And I could see where the torture porn started. There's a sequence in The Raid where a guy's sticking a machete through a wall to try to find cops hidden behind it. And I'm not going to spoil it, but there is a pretty insane display of pain tolerance and quick thinking to save that cop's life. I just blown away. This movie is more of everything.
Yes.
Which I really appreciated when it came to some of the action. But like I said, some of the overtop violence and especially the plot. I remember the first one, the plot, like, you know, I thought it was a brainless action film, but like by, I don't know, the halfway point of the movie, I'm like, oh, they're actually setting this interesting thing with this rookie. And I think his brother, I don't want to spoil it.
A gangster, but yeah, kind of doesn't want to be. It's weird.
Yeah, there's some interesting moral ambiguity and some family drama that they elevated it. And also some twists and turns in terms of like morality and loyalty and legality and who's playing who. And just the moving through three-dimensional space, the evasion of the gang members. Because that's The Raid is like, you know, this rookie is being sent out with a vice squad. They're going to take down these drug dealers. They get the police, the raid unit goes in, and the gangsters know they're coming, so they seal off the building, and now these cops are trapped with no way out, no way to get back up, and they have to fight their way out of this large, you know, square tenement building, I guess. The second movie begins immediately after the first, like it's like the immediately after the events of the first movie, they're still resolving, and it's about that rookie cop getting pulled into, this happens in the first 5 minutes, this isn't a spoiler, it's the premise. He gets pulled into an elite anti-dirty cop,
like internal affairs type.
And gets embedded in a criminal organization to take it down from the inside. And the plot was hard for me to follow because, like, the first 15 minutes of the movie, they're talking about, like, well, you're going to go into the criminal Jocko's enterprise, and his right-hand man is Blicko, and he's got the notorious assassin Xerxes, and it's just all these crazy names that had crucially no face to go with them. They're just talking about, you know, I felt like I going into The Godfather 2 without seeing The Godfather 1, and they're talking about Barzini and Tattaglia, and I'd not seen their faces. I'm like, who the hell? And I will confess that I was confused at the end of Godfather 2. I'd watched that a few times to understand all the mechanics, and that's kind of how I feel about this movie. There was a lot of moving parts. I'm not sure if they all connect. There's a couple situations I'm not sure why they played out without a person knowing something that they're not supposed to know. That might not be true. The action is fucking incredible. It starts off at the raid and just goes up from there.
Yeah, that's the thing. This is definitely like an expansion of the martial arts that they did in The Raid, which was already awesome. And it has a fight scene that I think is more memorable than anything that's in The Raid.
Let's talk about the spoiler section, because I want to know.
Yeah, we'll say maybe what our favorite fight scenes are. And it expands on the action just in general, too. Like, there are some car chases, which I think are pretty spectacular. It's not just martial arts action here. It's other kinds. And I found the plot also hard to follow. And I will say this is more The Raid in every way, because it's an hour longer than the original Raid 2. It's 2.5 hours.
It did feel that way, too, in places.
Occasionally, it felt a little long when I was very confused by the plot and who these people were. I was starting to look at my watch a little bit. And I will say they pace out the action fairly well. It's quite a bit up front, and then through the middle they keep you entertained with an action scene here or there as they're doing all this complicated plot stuff. But at the end, it's, you know, just like every martial arts action movie, they'll have the big fights, right? You just have an unbroken string of awesome fight scenes, and by the time we got to that, I was ready for that, and I felt like the movie overall is maybe, it's maybe not quite as good as The Raid, because it's not quite as simple as The Raid. And that's kind of what I was looking for in my Raid movies.
Yeah, I think the whole middle act of this film loses me, because I'm sure there's stakes, and maybe if I watch it again to know, but they essentially, every time you meet a new badass character that you have no relationship with, they have to establish them being a badass by having them have like a 5-10 minute long fight with, you know, their favorite weapon.
Sure.
But like, I don't know who they're killing, and I don't know who these people are. So this is just, I think it would work better if you had 30 seconds of them going at it with like their favorite weapon, and they get a phone call, be like, oh, you want? So it's like, oh, I see that guy. His thing is he uses a pair of pliers. He's got two pairs of pliers. I'm just making things up because I want to
use skateboards.
Yeah, this guy uses, this is the pipe wrench guy. Ooh, he's, I can't wait to see you knock teeth out of that. But it's like, you kind of get their best fights, and then they're introduced later, and I felt like, and then they do some really inexplicable stuff. Like, for example, when you're watching The Godfather, did you ever think, man, I really wish I had some scenes of Luca Brasi going back to his estranged wife and bickering with her about the child support and how often he gets to visit his kids and how she's disappointed and what kind of life he's living? It's like, you don't fucking want to see that.
Right.
Like, especially if you just saw Luca Brasi like kill a dude, and then like 15 minutes later you're getting this like long back story of family drama and stuff. Like,
yeah,
and I'm like, it didn't really pay off either, and that's where I felt like this movie felt inflated. Like, this guy loved everyone. Like, all the big guys in this have been Gareth Evans dudes from day one, and he wanted to like, okay, I'm not gonna just bring you on to punch people, I'm gonna give you some acting, and I think the movie suffered for it.
I do too. I think The Raid 1 is just this kind of nice, neat package, and trying to expand it out here to make it a more serious film. I don't know what he was trying to do with this, but I think it suffers for it. But I will say, not much. Like, I found myself several times pretty engrossed in the plot. And I think that's a testament to it, considering I barely knew who half these people were, and I barely knew how they related to each other. But as the movie went on and I got a little more comfortable with it, and by the end I understood who everybody was.
Yeah.
By name. And they could just say, yeah, this is Reza, this is Bangoon or whatever. And I settled into it, and I was enjoying the plot also. But I think it's the weakest part of this film is they tried to expand it out, and it's just like, I see what they're doing, right? I mean, those scenes with, you know, homeless hair man talking to his estranged wife and looking at lockets is like, yeah, that's trying to humanize his character so that when he fights, we'll have some stakes for him. But like,
didn't work.
I'm with you. I don't think it was necessary. Like, I don't know, because it ties into the plot. I'm expanding the plot out too much made this movie less than the initial Raid, in my opinion, even though the action is more than.
Yeah. It's like, if they came back with Dread 2 and, you know, now it's like, this is a movie that's going to, you know, the first Dread took one day. It's one building, one location. Raid, same thing. You know, if they had Dread 2 and it's like, okay, now it's going to be 3 or 4 years of Dread in an embedded underground investigation who's got to pretend to be a criminal, and you're going to meet all these other criminals, and there's going to be dirty judges and all this other stuff. Just a big sprawling thing that's going to be 2.5. Part of Dread's charm is it knew exactly what it was and it didn't overstay. It didn't try to buff. It's just, here's the guy's motivation. Here's the mission of the day. Here's the rookie cop. Throw him into the meat grinder. The Raid just 2 just has a lot more movie. And again, this is kind of like saying the Playboy was unsatisfying because the articles this month weren't so good, because no one is watching this movie for the plot. You are watching this for the insane athleticism, like stunts that it's very much the same as like watching a Jackie Chan film, where like, how are people not actually being crippled?
They have to be getting hurt. Several of these stunts, that's in my notes too. I'm like, yeah, people must have gotten hurt on this.
Yeah, like, and they're definitely using CGI blood and fake weapons and stuff. But like, when you're getting like pile droven from the top of a car onto the hood of the car, and the hood of the car visibly crumples, I don't. Yeah. And I know like half of them get thrown to concrete. They're probably using pads that are like gray and the camera's shaky and you can't quite tell. But it looks really convincing when they are breaking these guys' arms and legs and throwing them through. I saw a guy get hit by a car and driven through a cinder block wall.
Uh-huh.
And then it looked like they might have killed a guy. I don't know.
They might have.
That guy might have owed some money in Indonesia, and this is the only way he got his family out of debt. Like, it's insane. Sure. It's like watching Ben Hur, and it's like, well, which is the guy that got killed by
the
actually got killed by the chariot, yeah. You know?
No, for real. It's some of these stunts are really impressive in that I don't believe anybody could come out of that without a scratch. And I will say the action filming style, I think, is both a real plus and kind of a minus in some ways, because the thing that I love about it is those wide shots like I was talking about. You get to see all this action when somebody gets pile drive, and the reason we feel like, oh, that person must have got hurt, is because there's no cuts. Like they have somebody fighting on a car, a dude gets grabbed and then they jump off together and he gets smashed onto concrete floor. Like you just can't really fake that with the way they're shooting it, and that's awesome. However, I will say I kind of don't appreciate the extremely shaky cam. I know it lets them get away with a lot more.
Right.
And it makes it feel more kinetic, and it does that, but it also makes me just like say, God damn, hold the camera. I want to see what's happening here. And it's constant. There's never a shot in this entire movie during the action sequences that is on a tripod, that is even handheld in a steady way. It's constantly shaking.
Yeah.
And that got to me a little bit.
Not as bad as like Bourne 3, because that's my low water mark for like this is action. It's just being hidden by shaky cam.
That's the thing.
This
they're
is
not
very
really
good
hiding
action.
Much either.
I bet that does help hide some digital seams, especially when you're talking about like, you know, blood and
but not in the Jason Bourne way. In Jason Bourne, there's a cut every 0.3 seconds.
Yes.
In this, there's a cut maybe every 10 seconds.
Yeah. And it did seem the shakiness was a little bit worse than the first one. But again, you know, you are getting like top tier, completely insane action. Like, this is a 2.5 hour movie. I bet 2 hours of it is action.
Possibly.
Like I said, if I say this is a worse film, it's because it's just like maybe too much. I do think some of the middle does suffer from, you know, dubious like introducing too many characters and trying to make him meaningful so that they have a moment. It doesn't really work, at least not for me, because I'm not, you know, like this isn't that kind of film, man. This isn't isn't like a prestige thing where they're trying to jerk tears at someone's noble death. It's just, you know, you want to eat popcorn and watch somebody's the human body being broken down with fists and lead pipes and cinder blocks and whatnot.
And that's really the only way in which I think the plot is let down. It's slightly confusing, and maybe it doesn't belong in this movie, but I think everybody does a really good job of acting. All these performances are super believable. Even the ones that are a little over the top.
Go from good to serviceable. There are some of the... So you get out past like the main, you know, Rava... You get past Rava and like the son and the boss and some of the top
Bejo guy. It starts getting a little ridiculous, but
he's a little ridiculous in Crispin Glover. He's got like a Crispin Glover thing to him, right?
Sure.
He's like genteel but weird and angular and got a creepy affect. He's like like Crispin Glover in Charlie's Angels kind of guy. But I thought some of the henchmen and some of the stuntmen they got that are trying to do a little bit of acting, like there's a couple of like it's pretty god awful.
I didn't see that.
I thought some of their like reactions to getting like punched and stabbed and whatnot are also pretty ridiculous. But that might be intentional.
Yeah. I mean, that's just the style. I mean, these martial arts.
But some of them pull it off.
Reactions.
Some of them pull off getting like their Achilles tendon ripped off, and some of them don't. You know, some of them
sure.
Just don't quite sell it.
And there's some cheesy stuff in this movie, too, that I think should have been pulled out. There's a duo of fighters that I think is just kind of silly. I think they should have been taken out of the movie.
Yeah. And there's that's the thing, there's a big chunk of the movie too.
So
because obviously Gareth Evans is trying to make this very visually distinct. Like every fight kind of has a unique thing about its environment, the weapon, the number of dudes, like the elevation. There's like lots of things. And I think at some point, mm-hmm. some of those, you know, trying to give unique, you know, like, oh, this is the assassin and this is the crazy homeless guy and this is the guy that they went a little too far. And it's like, well, these are starting to feel like Batman villains. Like you've got Scarecrow and the Joker, you know.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's not like it's out of place necessarily in this genre. No, I mean, that is a thing that is done. It's just that didn't feel like what the Raid was about to me. And so when you introduce that into this series of films, it feels a little out of place.
Yeah, the Raid feels like a fucked up day, like a very gritty, like this is, you know, believable in an action that something happened. But there's a lot of these people like these guys don't read as real people to me.
Mm-hmm.
They read.
But then
as
there are a couple of fights. There's a fight against a guy who does read as a real person. That's just kind of amazing, which we'll talk about.
Like I said, this is really heavy violence. This is some stomach-churning stuff. There's also some just really hateful, like I said, near torture porn violence. Usually I recommend things like John Wick to almost anybody because like, I think most people don't take the violence seriously. The violence you could take seriously. So just be aware, you know, check out The Raid. And then because I do think that I don't know why anyone would watch The Raid 2 first. You watch The Raid, that's a perfect 90-minute, perfect action film. I put it up there with Dredd, the first John Wick, Fury Road. There's no fat, all good stuff. And if you like that, mm-hmm. then certainly watch The Raid 2 because the action is just so next level.
Yeah.
And there's also some really good soundtrack stuff. There's like this percussive, like someone playing wind chimes percussively. It's got like that hollow tuned metal tube kind of chiming sound, but also with like a drum kit, and it really punctuates and like is a metronome for some of this action. I thought I enjoyed that too. Filmmaking's probably, you know, nothing to write home about in terms of, you know, it's.
I mean, the action cinematography is very good.
Yeah.
They do some really interesting stunt kind of camera stuff, but.
But the dialogue scenes and stuff. I do. Yeah, you're right. The camera work, like it's, you can see these movies are super influential when, like, I think they did a lot to pioneer the, you know, super overhead kind of X-ray vision of the building of action. There's like a lot of funny stuff. Like there's this one particular shot where the guy's like punching, like a rabbit punches back head, and then you see the camera go to the guy's crotch. And then a guy's head like pokes out underneath his crotch with like this insane look on his face before he picks him up and he suplexes him onto the concrete and busts his head open. There's stuff like that that I just read as funny, you know.
There's a lot of comedy in these type of fight films too. Like I think back to The Protector, which is one of the funniest damn scenes in a martial arts movie I've ever seen. Yes. Where he just goes on a spree of joint.
The entire
joint manipulation
last
and 30
minutes of that film is a symphony of excess. Yeah.
And to me, it's hilarious. Yeah, there's some of that stuff in this movie for sure.
Yeah. All right. I think that's as spoiler free as we can probably keep it. I think you know exactly if you're going to watch this movie or not. Let's get to Ed's comments and then let's get some spoilers about this film. We'll be right back with more Bald Move after this brief pause.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes, only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
Since the dawn of time, we've been putting clothes on our back that identify us with our people, our group, our tribe.
And while Bald Move might be one of the smallest, weirdest tribes out there, transcending all concepts of border, class, culture, and creed, we still have respect for the old ways.
At support.baldmove.com, you can get t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more. We have something for every one of our podcasts, or just wear the four pips of the Bald Move logo with pride.
Bald Move merch beats running around naked, and they make a great gift for the Bald Move fan in your life. Join our tribe! Head over to support.baldmove.com and click on merch to start shopping. And now, back with more Bald Move. Hello, Jim, Aaron, and Talitha says, I am so ready to hear what you guys think about this movie. Let's do it. You can credit me as Ed, just another guy who loves action movies, and boy howdy, this is my favorite one. Dedicated to the upcoming Badass Fest 6 and the amazing Bald Move community to enjoy and spread the gospel of this lesser-known series. Longtime Bald Move fan, an action movie junkie, as well as a practicing martial artist, I wanted to commission something to prelude the Badass Fest. Inter Eco Uwais and Company. Pinchak Salat. I had to phonetically pronounce it. Practitioners, instructors from Indonesia, and Gareth Evans, the director of Raid movies. While the first Raid is a smaller setting tower climb a la Dread, with incredible action and choreography in its own right, it does not necessarily need to be seen first prior to the Raid 2, but it's highly recommended, as is all his Eco's catalog. This movie picks up right after the first with more budget, moreish plot, and more bona fide badasses that rival the greats in their prime and should be considered for the list. The best one-on-one fight I've seen on screen is here in the kitchen scene, he says in parentheses, and I hope you all enjoy. You may recognize Yahya Ruyan and Sisep Arif Rahman from John Wick 3. I'm sure them, along with Eco, were an inspiration for that franchise, and it's good to see them getting more deals. Cheers. I can't wait. Thanks for the always constant stream of great content. Well, thanks for being part of the stream here, Ed, commissioning this podcast. We really appreciate it. I have like essentially a stream of consciousness style notes on this one. I was just okay, writing down vibes, because again, I was fully probably two-thirds of this movie before I started putting together the plot. Basics, you know?
Sure.
Who's the weird guy, the Crispin Glover guy? Bayo?
That's Bejo.
Bejo?
Yeah.
I really liked his introduction. They kind of nailed... Oh, that's the other thing about this movie, is it's one of those things where the dub is not great and the subtitles are sometimes wildly different in what they were trying to say. Like, differences, not just in tone, especially, but in, like, meaning. So there's a lot of, like, where, like, well, the guy said that, but then the opposite said on the subtitles. What am I supposed to believe? But I thought he was, like, early on, they did a really good job of him being, like, that very kind of cruel, cold killer. Like, the type of guy who's like, oh, don't worry about those guys with the guns. You know, just pay attention to me. Like, you know, he's trying to befriend you before he kills you, and he's got these false manners and...
Yeah, I just wish he didn't have so many quirks. Like, his hair wasn't slicked down, and he didn't wear sunglasses, and he didn't have gloves, and he didn't have a cane and a limp. Like, they gave him every freaking quirk in the book, man.
It's Christian Glovering, yeah. He's Christian Glover in the first Charlie's Angels.
It was really hard for me to take him seriously because of the quirks of that character. But yes, he is a Stone Cold Killer, and I really like that scene where he puts Ucho, just call him like Joe through the movie. It's the mafia boss's son, where he kind of puts him to the test and starts to try and make this deal, right? He delivers these guys who tried to kill him in prison and offers them up on a silver platter to slit their throats. And like, he's kind of, Bejo's kind of sizing up Ucho throughout that scene, and just the coldness, like the complete lack of emotion with those killings, really impressed me.
There's some cool dialogue too. Like, I really like that Bejo, he's like here in this like Indonesian cornfield to kill this guy who's been poking around in his business, getting seen as dirt under his face. And he says, you know, this is a step-by-step type of business, and by my reckoning, you were still a few steps away from having this meeting, kind of telling that this guy was impetuous and ambitious and it got him in trouble. Plus, I was were you struck by how fucking Midwest that first scene felt when they're out in the fields?
In the, yeah, what could have been cornfields?
Yeah, like I'm sure it's got to be either bamboo shoots or rice or something else, but they have these like long, thick blades of grass that kind of bent over, and the way everything was green and the sky was kind of like that slate gray, slightly green, like a storm's running through, and the mm-hmm. insect sounds were exactly like what it sounds like in June in Indiana or Ohio. I thought, yeah, I was just struck by like, holy shit, this is Indonesia, but it feels like the middle of Ohio.
Yeah. Am I wrong to think that that is Rama's brother that they kill at the very beginning of this movie?
I don't know, because that's the thing. It's like, I remembered Rama. I remember that guy. Mm-hmm. And I guess the corrupt lieutenant, although I don't know if it's the same guy, because I don't think we got a good look at his face. There were so many dudes getting snatched up and killed in shady circumstances in the first 5 minutes of this film that that's where I started having trouble. Like, is he worried about his brother? Is he waiting to hear if his brother got died? Is that the leverage they used to get? Because I'm not sure exactly what leverage they used to get him into the thing. And then what eventually happens to this guy, I was like, how the hell do you go in for a couple of months and end up in prison for 3 years? On mission? Like,
yeah, sure.
They had a guy come in and be like, yeah, this is what's happening to you. And no, I'm not going to get a message out to the, because I've already done. And I'm like, well, why is this happening? I don't.
Yeah, I can't tell if it was like a timing thing with the son of the boss getting out at the same time, Ucho, or if that was like a, because he killed a bunch of people in the first fight. Like, he kills, and it's not like he incidentally kills people. He tries to kill a few dudes.
Because he's angry. He's like, but why is he angry? Because he volunteered kind of, sort of, for this mission. It was, he had his difficult conversation with his wife. Hey, I'm going to go away for 3 months. You can't ask any questions, but if I don't do this, I can't protect this.
It's because they killed his brother, and I think he's getting caught up in that, right?
Yeah, yeah. But he way overdoes it and kills a bunch of people. So I guess now he's got legitimate charges. They're talking about this guy's son, but they never, like, I could have really used a dossier photo, or if there was one, I didn't put it together because, you know, again, there's, like, I'm trying to pay attention to subtitles, dubs, all this stuff.
Right.
But Is this your favorite fight? Because I know you love hallway fights, and I thought this is like the craziest hallway fight I've ever seen, because it's a guy fighting into a hallway from a cement box, and he keeps getting thrown back into cement box. And
No, it's a pretty cool fight. It's not my favorite. But it's cool. He's fighting in a bathroom stall. It's a big stall, and it's all concrete. So, like, the door is the only way out, and he's fighting like 20 dudes. I think they say he beats at least 15 senseless, or maybe kills 15. You get a lot of time for killing 15 people, though.
Yeah. And that's like, you know, where they're doing this, you know, they do that thing where they pan above, and there's like the ceiling's cut away, so you can kind of see the dimensions and where the guys are coming.
Yeah. No, it's that's a cool where fight, but not my favorite.
They got the between the crotch demented face close up on Rama, where he's just like, he's in this frenzy, and then he still hasn't got enough, because like the next scene he's like beating a cinder block wall until it crumbles.
Yeah, and I assume they undercrank the camera a little bit. They speed this up, but my God, just the flash, the flurry of punches and elbows and knees and shit that he delivers to this wall, and crumples the plaster on it and stuff. Yeah. It's impressive.
So right after the fight, he's gotten the notice of both the crime boss's son and this other guy, Goto's, I guess, enforcer or lieutenant. And they come and kind of talk to him in sequence. And he's at a cafeteria table. And, you know, you're filming from the side. You can see this guy's whole body, top, bottom. Did you notice this Iwo guy, how big his fucking feet were? Because he's just wearing flip-flops. This guy's feet are so wide, like his toes have such a I swear to God, this guy standing on one foot has a wider stance than I do with my feet planted shoulder width apart.
Wow.
He's got like Maui from Moana feet.
All right,
Like these feet have been feet that have kicked steel pipes and cinder blocks since he's 5 years old. He could probably rip a phone book in half with his feet, is what I'm saying.
Probably.
He's got opposable toe thumbs, and he's just sitting there casual. Like, they're just, I think it's the only time you see him barefoot in the whole movie. He's just sitting there. And I'm like, I don't know if it's a camera angle. I don't know if it's digital effects. The man has got a hell of a foundation.
Damn. All right. I didn't notice. I try to avoid looking at people's feet.
Well, sometimes you can't. Sometimes you can't look away when you see something that impressive.
There's another really good fight scene here in a second, which is the muddy yard. I mean, and you know it's coming, right? Like, they show the establishing shot as this overhead of the prison yard that's just soaked through, and there's just layers of thick, gooey mud, and you know, oh, there's going to be a big fight scene in this mud.
The thing is like, a lot of times this film, it's like, you know, there's other films. I know, what was the one? Like Cobra. When we're watching Cobra and they take us through the bad guy's lair and it's like, oh, there's a vent that's gouting flames and there's a hook on a chain. At some point, someone's going to end up in that chain. You see these things coming, but you just don't understand the scale. You don't know that they're going to spend 15 minutes in this mud.
Yeah.
And that by the end, this is going to look like some kind of World War One battlescape where there's just divots and craters and blast holes from where these guys have been pile driving each other and
filled with mud and blood and bodies and parts. Yeah, this is where the really grisly leg trauma stuff starts. Like, he gets a hold of a knife in this yard and he takes it to one guy's leg, starts at about the mid-thigh, and just drags that thing down every tendon and muscle he has all the way to the ankle. And I'm like, I can't watch that.
There's not enough.
And not like a straight drag. It's like a jagged, never putting this back together kind of drag.
Also, everything's covered in mud, which I imagine is at least a little shit and piss, so there's also the sepsis involved. Yeah,
sure.
There's not an orthopedic surgeon in the world that's going to be helping that guy. Did you notice a dude doing a real life bloater kill?
No.
There was like, as they're panning over to get to our star, there's a guy in the foreground that's got his hands in a dude's mouth pulling his jaws apart, and you can start to see the face rip. I'm like, right. I didn't think I'd ever see that in real life. I've seen it in a video game. I've now seen it in The Last of Us, but holy shit, he did a bloater. Just popped a dude's top off like it's a Pringles can.
Yeah. And you can see how hard it is to actually fight in this stuff, too, because they're really fighting in this thick mud. This isn't CG. And you can see Ewell just kind of like slipping and sliding as he's trying to
struggling,
get his stance.
Yeah.
And another guy's coming in at him. And like, it feels like it was harrowing just to fight through this in the stunt work.
Yeah, I've got my notes that there's the Keystone Cops of police brutality, because there's something almost Benny Hill-like in the way these cops storm the yard as a single unit with their batons, and they all just converge on, they don't like break up and like, okay, you take those guys. They just all as a group just mob some dude and just work him over with the clubs.
Uh-huh.
And it played as really funny to me. Like, you had that, and it's a Benny Hill skit.
Yeah. If Benny Hill was really into disfiguring and maiming people.
Yeah. No, there's some absolute moments of savagery in this blood. And the whole point of this scene is someone's trying to start a riot to kill the mob boss's son. And the mob boss gets knocked out and Rama has to save him. So he's kind of now got a life debt that he owes him, I guess.
And it gets him in good with him, right? Like two years later, I guess he doesn't get any additional time for these murders that he commits in the yard here. But 2 years later, he's getting out and Ucho, the mob boss's son, shows up to pick him up.
Mm-hmm. And he takes him to his father. And the other thing is, I'm guessing he hasn't talked to his like police contact for several years. And they give him, you know, they've planted bugs in his clothes, right? They put a wire, and he gets angry, rips it all out. But then when he goes to the mob boss, the first thing he does is like have him strip naked, completely naked.
Yeah.
And there's this hilarious line where it's like, hey, look, if the worst thing that you suffer is the indignity of an old man seeing your cock, you're going to get off easy. And there's this little bit of like paranoia because like, oh, my God, did I get all of it ripped out? But he did. He's clean. And
you get kind of caught up in this scene, too. At least I did. I'm like,
this was
no,
effective,
because,
yeah, I cared about
sure
Rama.
Who. I did too, yeah, especially after the first movie. You really care about this guy. And I wasn't sure if he had put the bug on himself, but he got rid of it, so why would he do that?
Right.
And so there was a tension here of, like, maybe there are more bugs he just didn't find, doesn't know about.
Right.
And so when they're really strip-searching him and, like, checking his clothes and all the seams in it to make sure there's nothing sewn in, I'm like, oh, my God. And then the hilarious part, I'm so caught up in that. The funniest part to me is when they cut to a different angle at the end of all of that, and you can see the receptionist is just in the background looking through the glass door. Mm-hmm. It's not just the old man who's seen his cock. Everyone, like, in the lobby has.
Two enforcers. It's the guy with the clothes. It's the, yeah, yeah. You're in a glass
poor
office.
Poor receptionist out there, yeah.
And I was thinking at this, like, at what point in this movie does Rama, because, like, the whole reason he's in this thing is because this old cop that wants to recruit him in this internal affairs, his first plan is, we're just going to kill these guys. We know who they are. We're just going to, and Rama's like, oh, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to do this the right way. 3.5 years in prison, old man seeing his cock, going up between his ass cheeks, checking for bugs. At what point does this guy just wish, you know, I should have just killed these cops? Because I'm killing so many people without trial.
And by the end, he's going to do that anyway. So,
right.
Like, not the cops, but the bot. He gets told by, you know, another undercover guy that he's got to just go kill him because the heads keep popping up. You got to take them all off.
I love how understated the phone call to his wife is, because I think you're supposed to understand it. He hasn't talked to his wife. So that's the other thing. They leave him alone with a fresh set of clothes, and they give him a cell phone, and underneath his tongue, he's had a SIM card. So he spits it out, and he gets, and he calls the cops, and he bitches them out for trying to get him killed, which, fair point. I don't know why. Oh, you just got out of prison. They're not going to check. No, they checked him on day one. Second thing he does is he calls his wife.
Yeah.
And, like, how understated her reaction is, like, oh, my God, you're still alive? Oh, shit, I've been dating the like, none of that. She's just like...
Years later. It was like a couple months.
Yeah, she's almost like, well, you're like, her reaction is like, he's running 10 minutes late with the milk coming home from work, you know? Bizarre. Yeah. Like, they spent more time developing Luca Brasi's relationship with his baby mama than they did with Rama and his family, you know?
Yeah, and I can't remember if I'm supposed to understand a lot from the first one, because it has been, you know, a little while.
I don't think they even introduced it. He might have.
I didn't think so either. I thought that thing started during the raid and ended during the raid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like it's. But, I think you're like at the briefing and they're on the way driving, and then.
Yep.
So this,
I will say, all expenses paid by this mob boss sets him up with just a kind of amazing pad.
Yeah.
And the first thing he does is make an out and proud phone call here to the cops and his wife.
Yeah.
I'm thinking this place is bugged floor to ceiling.
Yeah,
I can't get away with shit here. I need to find a dive bar or something to make this call from.
So one of the first jobs he does is there's a pornographer.
Uh-huh.
That is operating under auspices of this gangster's son's organization, and he's started doing, I don't know, like, you know how mob bosses don't like it. If you're a pornographer, you should just do pornography, and if you want to go into, you know, drug or whatever, you got to give me the cut. Well, this guy's doing the classic thing where he's branching out, but he's not giving the boss the cut. So the thing is like, here's like, you go to this pornographer, and have you seen Austin Powers? Where, like, in Austin Powers 2, like, Heather Graham is, like, Austin Powers bent over getting some out of his suitcase, and she's behind him, and she's unpacking her suitcase, and it looks like she's taking, like, watermelons and tennis rackets and bowling balls and all kinds of crazy things out of his ass, and all you can see is the shadow against it.
Classic.
They do that, except for there's a prostitute fucking the shit out of a dude who I don't think is there consensually.
No, this is a snuff operation kind of thing.
Is it snuff? Did they establish?
I don't know if they're gonna like kill him, but they're definitely right. Like non-consensual.
Yeah,
stuff,
they abducted him off the street. Snuff. He took the wrong turn, and they're brutalizing him, and they're playing that as comedy. Interesting choice.
Yeah.
So there's this very long, excruciating long negotiation scene where the guy's like, "Oh, you owe me money. Oh, I don't know what you're talking about. No, you're a little late. I don't know." And, you know, Ram is there as his enforcer. And there's this scene where it's clear there's going to be violence. Like, the guy at the head of the table slowly backs away from the table, slowly puts his hands under the table. The guys at his side are also withdrawing their hands conspicuously from the table, putting their hands. And as obvious as you think I'm being, it's 100 times more obvious. And they have Rama like looking at him, like, what's going on? And then he sees a reflection of water under the table where the guy's like going for a shotgun. And I'm like, I think the blind hammer girl can see what's going on here. You don't need to see the reflection. Yeah. But I thought that was like it's really long drawn out. And it's almost like I wonder if Gareth Evans is like, I'm intentionally doing some of this to be funny.
I mean, some of it definitely. This moment, I'm not sure.
It felt like something out of the Naked Gun or something. I thought it's not bothering. I just thought it was hilarious.
But it leads into a really cool chase/fight scene, I thought. Guys jump through windows and I don't know. Doing some pretty gruesome stuff also. We'll be right back with more Bald Move after this brief pause.
You've been listening to quite a few Bald Move podcasts now, but you're not in the club? Whoo boy, you are missing out.
Not only are all of our premium club podcast feeds completely ad-free, but we have lots of other great content exclusively for people in the club.
There's a weekly lunch with Jim and Aaron where we chat with fans about anything and everything from TV and films, food, fun, life advice, and more.
But there's also Off the Clock, our premium podcast where we talk about all the shows we don't have time for on our public feeds.
Plus, you get access to our full spoiler-filled first-run movie reviews of our newly released films.
Don't forget Instant Take and Talk podcast, where we give our hot takes and discuss television shows with our fans live and immediately after the episode airs.
With mega shows like House of the Dragon coming this summer, we're going to have lots to talk about.
Not to mention access to our fun and friendly community of club members, with exclusive Discord channels and a dedicated forum. It's one of the best places on the internet to hang out and chat about pop culture.
Bottom line, you're helping two regular type guys in the Midwest make the content you like to listen to, which some would say is rewarding to itself.
Help keep the lights on and the bits flowing at Bald Move.
And get some awesome content for yourself. Head to support.baldmove.com to join the club today.
We try to make it super easy to support making podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club.
But some people aren't the joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for a podcast that really spoke to them, or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love.
And now, back with more Bald Move.
Yeah, and there's, like I said, this is where the genuinely disturbing violence is, because there's a scene of, like, this mob boss's son brutalizing these sex workers and, like, threatening their lives and all this other stuff. The scene where they introduce the guy who looks like the homeless man killer with the machete. And when he like takes off for his target, he's like with a woman on a date and he like throws the woman at this guy because he's so afraid. like the way a hero in action movie would like turn over, like throw a trash barrel to slow him down. He just takes this woman and he shoves him at her and runs in a different direction.
I love that fight because I think there's something so intimidating about the confidence of a man with a machete who's fighting like 15 people but never uses the machete. Because he doesn't kill anybody with this machete until the very last guy.
Right, right.
He doesn't even hit him with the machete. He's just like kicking them and throwing them into the side as he goes after this other dude.
It's what are you going to do with that machete? What are you going to do with the machete?
yep.
But I don't know. I just thought I guess why we're talking about this guy. This is the Luca Brasi guy I'm talking about, where this movie kind of like crap. First of all, I didn't know who the hell this guy was. Like, it seemed to bizarrely cut to this guy, you know, collecting this contract. And I'm like, okay, well, I just got to keep an eye on this straw haired guy with the crazy look. But then he's in like a food court of a mall with this beautiful woman. And he hands her this bag of money. And she's like, okay, same time next week or whatever. And he's like, no, I need to talk. And they have this earnest conversation. He's very polite. He's very like submissive and demure to her. Like, you know, I just I've been really good lately. And, you know, what about this? And you appreciate that he's talking to his estranged wife.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess they've been divorced for 15 years. And he didn't used to be a psycho killer, but he's been a psycho killer somehow. And
yeah,
he wants
to
see
his
son.
Was so fucking disgusting. Her exact words. They never tell us what he did that was so fucking disgusting.
And you get the idea that he used to be like handsome or like presentable, and now he's just turned into just like Tom Hanks, fresh off the island kind of looking guy with like, he's not unkempt. It's like he hasn't been kept for years. And it was just such an odd choice to give who a guy is just a ruthless killer this backstory to, I guess, engender empathy for when, because there's also a scene where like they set up, the mob boss's son, like he and him has some kind of plausible like uncle nephew close relationship, and none of that stuff really played. And when this guy eventually gets killed, they don't play it as like a moment that's sad or anything. It's like, it's weird they spend so much time developing the character of this guy, and it just felt like Gareth Evans being nice to a guy who helped him get started. Like, I'm gonna give you some juicy acting stuff. It's not gonna just be punching people, but it just doesn't serve the story or go anywhere.
I mean, you can quibble about the execution of it, but what they're going for is on the screen and evident, and it ties into the plot. And like,
tell me how
this guy. So this guy is this Yan guy. I forget his name.
He's the top enforcer of the mob boss's army.
And he is an actor, a martial artist that Gareth Evans has worked with. He worked with him in the first raid. You when you see him, you'll remember him from the first raid.
Yeah. He plays an insane gangster in the first one. Yeah.
Yeah. And I've read an interview with Gareth that he was saying, I will never do a martial arts movie without this guy involved. And so he wrote this part for him. And this whole story started as like kind of a different thing. He had a script that he had written and an idea in his head for this plot for this different movie that I forget the name of, but he adapted it into this film. And so he had to kind of write Rama into this movie. So maybe that's where it's getting lost in translation. But for me, the way this is supposed to work, and you can argue about whether it did, is this guy is the longtime enforcer and assassin, hitman, whatever, of this, this mob boss. And he kind of grew up as the uncle to Ucho, who it was the kid, and so they might have a relationship there. But to me, Ucho, like, he's playing this cynically as like, oh, this is my uncle, you know, when he's talking later on, like, they killed him, they killed my uncle, god damn, my uncle. And that's all, like, the reason he's going so hard on that with both his dad and also the mob bosses later is because he's trying to instigate this fight between the Japanese and Beijo, because this Beijo guy wants to get a little more space to operate. I don't know. He's trying to branch out too. And they say, well, we can start a war by killing some foot soldiers. And he's like, no, we has to be somebody important to my father, because foot soldiers aren't going to get him to declare war. And so they kill this guy. And so you need to understand, like, this is someone who's been in the family and has been around a long time, and he's important to them. So that when they kill him, it'll be kind of a shock that they won't go to war for him.
That's a long way to go for various.
I agree.
They could have just been like, yeah. "But Dad, he's your top enforcer. We're like, you know, we're dying out there without him collecting and busting heads, and like that. That's all I need." And but you saying that he wrote this like that he took two movies and put them together makes a lot of sense, because I was about to say this role reminded me a lot of like Leon the Professional. Like, there's dim-witted, kind of kind-hearted, gentle guy who's been pressed into this brutal life because he doesn't know how to manage his finances, and like some person that took him in, like Luca Brasi, you know, like he's a stupid, brutal guy that's insanely loyal because he doesn't know any better. And like, he feels like the hero from another story that just shows up in the middle of Rama's story. And it's probably because that's exactly what he is.
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. And he probably in the original version that like had these big and barely survived, was able to kill everybody. And then he killed the boss and he's able to go home to his wife and son because he's. But I don't know. It's just felt like this really big fleshed out character that just dies so he can be used as a. And again, I don't like any of this stuff. It's just I think I would have liked this movie if it was shorter.
I think so too.
And a little bit more condensed, a little more concise.
But I do like the fight scene that comes from this. This guy is an excellent martial artist. If you didn't see him in Raid 1, he's got some real skills, and he kind of displays them here in the club fight. The club fight's really cool. Again, not
club
my
fight
favorite
is
yet,
awesome.
But the club fight, I love the layer, the levels to it. Right, he's jumping in and out of the booths, and there's just a lot of dynamic movement there.
I have in my notes, it's Batapalooza, because this guy takes so many baseball bats, like lethal hits to baseball bats. There's like the Keystone, like a half a Keystone Cops of brutality on him, where there's like six dudes like hammering him from the back while he's killing someone in a bar. An unusual amount of broken bottle knife, just like savage, like the guy will take it and like take the bottle, break it on the drum, and then like, you know, you've seen the cookie cutter move. He does this to a guy's neck and like scoops it out.
Yeah.
And the other thing that really, like, you have a whole 5-minute ass fight, and then it looks like he's going down, he's succumbing, and then it goes like, you know, takes a pause, and you're now outside the club, like looking out a side door, and you think you've transitioned to another scene, and it holds that beat for like several seconds, and then a door busts open, and the machete guy's not dead, and there's another five minutes of the fight that's going to go happen outside. It's like I felt like I had to like go get a towel and a water bottle and like mop down after a workout after I saw that fight.
Yeah, that's great.
So there's the, I think we're both in agreement that the deaf baseball bat guy and the blind hammer girl.
Yeah, it's too much.
Yeah, because that's what I'm saying. I'm like, I said, we have a deaf and a blind assassin. And one of them's got a two-face motif where she's flipping a coin, and they use hammers.
And
it's
uses
like
hammers.
Yeah,
and he uses the baseball bat, but not the bat itself. He uses the baseball mostly. Like, yeah, it's all just too quirky. It feels like it belongs in a different movie.
Some of it was cool, like just out of isolation. There's this dude. He got like the baseball bat guy got like a 20-hit combo on one dude, and. The way he was using the momentum of the bat to keep the guy on his face or on his feet so he could still combo him, like the guy would start to fall back and he would like tee him up from the other direction. It was really neat. And I thought the claw hammers were, especially because you're thinking the hammer, you're going to use the business. She's using the claw end.
That too, yeah. She uses like, the whole hammer.
Like removing dudes' livers like they're a bad nail in the roofing deck, you know, just stick it in there and lever it out. But it's the setup that we're
silly.
We need
the action is cool, but the whole premise of it is silly, and I don't know, I really just didn't need it in this movie. It feels like it comes out of some tongue-in-cheek Japanese action film to me. As opposed to what I thought was a grittier, a little more grounded series here.
Yeah, strange. It's bordering on like Kung Pao Enter the Fist with how colorful and over the top the characters are. But there's another one where Rama is in a taxi and he's trying to go. I think the boss has recalled him and he gets jumped by a bunch of corrupt cops. I really like this scene because the guys, you know, he's in the back seat. They, you know, the driver's getting where they're going, and you see this guy with like a lead pipe running up, and he just smashes the driver's head in.
Oh my God, yeah.
And then all the guys smash the windows, and they all have these like 18-inch kitchen knives, and they're all stabbing, and Rama is just like in the middle, snaking between the knife gouges to get his hand on the throttle so he can just floor it and get the hell out of there.
It reminded me of the scene from Shaun of the Dead where the zombie, one of them turns and they're beating it with pool cues to the beat of Queen.
Yeah.
It felt like that. It in like how over the top it is with all these knives coming at it from every direction.
I could tell it's CG, but it looks like this guy is just inches or no, not even inches, like half inches away from being stabbed by, again, it's like 8, 10, so many knives.
Yeah. Every direction, coming in the back window, coming in the sides. And then he gets to the front seat and he presses the gas, takes off, and there's guys hanging on the car and he's trying to, and then he manages to shake them all, but he crashes the car because he can't see where he's going. He's in the wheel. Right. He's in the footwell of the car.
Yeah, head down, ass up, with his head in the where your feet should be, and his feet are kicking out the side. Yeah.
So he manages to get away long enough to at least get out of the car by crashing it. And then he has to fight them all. And my God, there's just this great restaurant fight scene. Like, I can't imagine being a patron in this restaurant where, like, this crazy dude busts in with 15 people chasing him, and he's punching and kicking, kicks all their asses, and then he grills a cop's face on the hibachi.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Or whatever they call it. Like, yeah, if you're a patron there, that's crazy, man.
That'll scrape it down. Put some water on there, scrape it down.
Sure. Start it back up.
There's a bunch of broken bottle knife stabs that are just vicious.
Yes.
And the big thing at the end of this is at the end, the last guy he kills, you can see he's got a police badge on.
Yep.
So it's like, oh, it's some more dirty cops trying to fight back. Which, again, for an undercover ring that's taking down dirty cops, they do that a surprisingly little amount of time. It's mostly about the mob guys, I guess. But
yeah, I want to ask you a question about the plot.
Yeah.
And maybe this is a fool's errand here, but like, Rama finds out that Ucho is working against his father here. He's made a deal to try and expand Bejo's territory and got this Koso guy, the crazy homeless looking dude, killed. He knows about all this. He has it on video, in fact, them meeting together. He never tells the boss. Why doesn't he tell the boss?
Well, why would he? Like, isn't his assignment to take, so by the end of the movie,
his assignment
dead.
Is to get evidence of corruption.
Yeah. And killing these guys are not going to do it, but everyone dies at the end anyway. So it's like, yeah, that's why, you know, I'm wondering if this wouldn't have been better as like an hour 50 movie or something, because
so much of
the extra layers they put on. Yeah. And I think he's trying to recreate the, oh God, these are and he's the gang. Oh, and that he's trying to recreate that, but it just ended up for me being way too broke. And some of these characters, yeah. I never took the mob boss's kid seriously.
Yeah, and neither did the mob boss, right? His name's Bon-Goon.
Yeah, there's this scene, or you know the scene in The Godfathers where the heads of the five families meet and they're around the table after Michael goes to Italy and Sonny gets killed, and they're discussing, you know, how that they can resolve the situation and move forward peacefully. There's one of those scenes where it's the Japanese gangster versus the Indonesian gangster, and they both have their lieutenants and their sons there, and there's the head of the big crime boss, and they're saying, you guys got to make nice. You know, like you said, the kid is trying to goad his father into a fight. So he goes, has his big emotional reaction. His father has to apologize and cede territory to the Japanese guy just to keep the families at war. And he goes home and he just beats the shit out of this kid. This kid has this hilarious reaction where, like, his dad is like slapping and beating him and kicking him, and it's just poorly dubbed. Dad, okay, dad, wait, dad, no, wait, dad, as he's just getting taken punch and punch and punch.
Uh-huh.
And then, so he's so stoic in that. And then when he starts screaming at his dad about, like, you never loved me, you never thought it, he sounds so much like Luke wanting to go to Tosche Station to get power converters.
Sure.
That yeah. I'm like, this guy, plus he's like such a terrible, he's like so terrible to women and so casually cruel. He reminded me of like Commodus from Gladiator crossed with whiny Luke Skywalker from A New Hope. And it's just,
I mean, it's the point of his character. I guess you just found it annoying because it is the point. Like he is this impetuous child who wants to move up, but daddy won't let him and he doesn't understand why. And so he makes these moves that eventually destroy the family. That's a fine story. You just, I guess, didn't like the way
it's
it was
like,
done.
So, like, one of the things I think that bothers, I still think Gladiator is a great movie. Just watched it like 4 weeks ago. But every time I watch it, I just don't buy that Commodus can beat, like Russell Crowe kicks this Roman emperor's ass from the slave pits. Do you understand how insane that is, that you got politically outplayed? By a guy who you literally hold in your palm like a plaything? And it's just his stupid ego and how just deeply stupid and incurious and oblivious he is. It's this
and
guy.
How like put upon he feels when he clearly has it made. It's like
right. And this guy gave me that kind of energy where just like it's kind of like Commando where so the individual henchmen, like, you know, the old crazy long-haired homeless guy and the assassin and the hammer girl and the baseball, those guys I take seriously as villains, but the guy on top, I just, you know, it's like, I don't know. It's like, what do you do? It's your son. You know, you got a bad, it's like John Wick, you know, you had Theon Greyjoy as a son. You fucked up. You should have sent better sperm. You should have choose better eggs. It's out of your hands now. But this guy, it's like, I was like, at multiple points in this movie, I'm like, how am I supposed to feel about this guy getting the hand over this guy versus this guy? Like, other than Ramen, he's out of the picture for like 30 minutes at a time when you're dealing with the drama between the son and his dad and the son and the gangster who's obviously manipulating him. And some of it is also, there's that one scene where the Godos, I guess, henchman that's trying to screw him over has provided him all the guys in the mud fight to slit their wrist with a hobby knife or slit their throat with a hobby knife, which is a horrific scene. That's one of the ones
I've seen. It's
felt
hard to
most
watch,
uncomfortable but, because it did feel like I was watching a snuff film, like, you know, Mexican cartel guys killing dudes, you know, just
I agree. I had to kind of look away a little bit when he was cutting throats.
Yeah,
but I think it does a lot to service that character. I think Ucho isn't a guy I take seriously at all until this scene.
I still don't take him seriously because he's like, he's still an idiot. He's just an idiot. He's like a Joffrey. He's a, like Commodus. He's an idiot capable of great cruelness and casual brutality. But he's still
You gotta be afraid.
He's still
of that
a fucking
guy.
Idiot.
Yeah, he's an idiot.
You gotta be afraid of Commodus.
Power,
sure, yeah,
you know. I mean, he's willing to use it.
We'll be right back with more Bald Move after this brief pause. Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun, fan-favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what two-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info.
And now, back with more Bald Move.
But I just don't know why Rama doesn't tell him, because I feel like there's a point where he could have moved up in this chain. He could have said, look, your son has met with this guy. They're plotting to take you out. I've got the video evidence here. We can watch it together and make the shit up. And then he could have kind of taken a step up toward getting to the corruption part, right? Because I don't think Uhtred's the one paying cops. I think his dad is.
Yeah, so I don't... I got another question. In the scene... So after that scene where they got the slit throats and after meeting Godfather and after he beats him up, there's a scene where his son betrays his father and shoots him in the face.
Yeah, yeah.
And then he's going to kill his right-hand man, who turns out to be an embedded cop, too. And Rama busts in and saves him. Can you explain to me why Rama saved this guy in this circumstances? Like, as the undercover cop trying to bring this gang down. Because they have the whole, like, there's a whole sequence of events and a whole car chase. And you find out that this guy's a cop and he's known about Rama, but Rama's not known about him.
Yeah.
Why would he save this shithead from his perspective?
That's a really good question.
Like, he's abandoning the mission to save this guy right now. Because once he does this, the jig's up. They're going to know that, like, I don't know if you're a cop or not, but we can't trust you with our organization anymore.
Yeah, totally. I couldn't actually tell you why. Maybe he just thinks that Uhtred didn't. Well, he knows that Uhtred's betraying him. Yeah, no, I
can't.
That's
what I'm saying. Yeah, because like it's nothing that I could by looking. But maybe I missed something. Maybe there was he recognized it. But they play him telling them a cop later as a revelation. I felt like.
Yeah, they do. Yeah, so, this is his name.
The
Reza?
Other question?
No, it's Eka. I don't know.
The other question I have is why. Did they not kill Rama there? Like, usually when there's like, because like, you know, Rama didn't provide a distraction, let that Eka guy away. And it's like, you know, usually it's like, well, they're in a public place or whatever. Like, we got to take him to a field and kill him. Mm-hmm. You just blew your old man's head off in his office. He's dead, bleeding at your feet. You've got a dead body to get rid of. Why don't you just kill Rama there? Why do you have to take him away other than so he can get. That's what I'm saying. Like, this is where there's too many moving parts. They've lost the plot.
Yeah, I'm with you. I don't understand the Eka stuff, but if I'm trying to play, trying to create some headcanon here, you can look at Ucho and he's just like kind of in shock. He's just standing here, like I just killed my father. He's trying to figure out his life in that moment, and they ask him like, "What do you want us to do with Rama? What do you want us to do with this guy?" And he doesn't respond. So he knows like. Bejo knows that this guy saved his life twice, and I think maybe Bejo just doesn't want to go off half-cock, kill this guy, and then have Uhtred go, "You killed my friend, you asshole," right? Like, he might still need him for
away.
His dudes.
I definitely felt like it was take him away and do away with him, but maybe...
Oh, maybe. I don't know. It's just, like I said, headcanon. I don't know that that's actually even what they're going for. I want to go back briefly to the Godfather style scene, the meeting.
Yeah. Because
They do something really weird in this scene, and I don't understand it. This entire movie, they've been speaking in their native language or in Japanese, and some mix of the two, and doing subtitles. And in this one scene, they switch to pure English for... For a back and forth that maybe goes back and forth 4 or 5 times, and then they switch back to Japanese and Indonesian, and I don't understand it.
Were they trying to do the Shogun thing where when the guy was talking, apologizing in Japanese, that you're supposed to understand that is actually Japanese? I don't know. Because honestly, I didn't catch that with all everything being dubbed and subtitled. I didn't even catch that there was a... I saw that because of subtitle that he was saying in Japanese, and the guy then, you know, said, "I can't believe you apologize on our land in their tongue," and, you know, all this stuff. But like, yeah, I didn't get that.
Maybe it's a translation through this guy's earpiece, because there's also a weird thing he's doing where he's touching his earpiece, the Goto guy. And I don't know what that's about.
Yeah, he's literally translating for Goto. They have a translator at the table who's like retranslating in English everything that guy says.
Why even bother? Like, I don't know. It's such a weird
this
moment.
This movie's probably dubbed in 16 different languages and subtitled in 17 others. I wonder.
Sure.
You know.
Yeah, that was just weird. But then there's this awesome chase scene, which I think is really good.
Gareth Evans flexing his action muscles a bit. I did not expect a very well executed gonzo car chase. Yeah, there's a lot of there's some digital effects here. Like when they hit some dude with a car door at 50 miles an hour and it like dismembers him. It's like, yeah, that didn't actually happen. Or when the guy smacks his head on the cement when he's dangling outside, like clearly, but it's good. Like, I think it's better than like John Wick 4, you know, that when they're doing that Tokyo drifting around the Arc de Triomphe. That was very CGI car. I was watching kind of a muddy 1080p Amazon transfer. But yeah, I had a hard time telling where the digital seams began and end in that. And I thought it was that when he unloads his gun in that dude's motorcycle helmet.
Oh, God. Yeah.
That was fucking wild.
It's a mix of action stuff here too, because they're driving at high speeds, they're doing car stunts, but there's also another one of these close quarter inside a car fights. Because like Rama wakes up, you know, he's been knocked out. They put him in the back seat with two dudes flanking him and two guys in the front, one driving, and he wakes up and he sees that this Eka guy is following them and crashing into him and trying to rescue him, and so he springs into action, starts fighting these guys in the back seat and the front seat and in the trunk, and it's just kind of awesome. This close quarters, they have knives, they have fists, they have legs, they're like kicking through windows, and oh the leg trauma doesn't end there.
This is my favorite thing in the entire movie.
So he's got one guy on one side of the car and he's on the other, and the guy tries to kick him and he dodges and he kicks through the window, and then Rama grabs his leg and smashes it down on the frame of the window where the glass shards are and drags it across. It's horrible.
It is the least amount of leg trauma that you're going to see with Bladed, but somehow it's just so funny and kind of petty. Like, you missed me, I'm going to take it and just drag your leg on this cheese crater that goes to the guy's face as he just like tilts his head back and screams.
Yeah.
That's the funniest, best leg trauma. Although, so this kind of spirals out, and this leads directly into the, you know, like once he gets here and the guy, you know, the guy who drove him, who is the guy he saved, the Aka guy in the previous scene, and he explains he's a cop. He gets the eye of the tiger and he's ready to go to the headquarters and shut all this shit down. The running fight he does, like he did this thing where like a guy scissor kicks him and he goes and kicks back and he kicks the guy's leg, but then he also like grabs him into a leg hook and then twists and tumbles and does like, I usually that happens with people's hand, you know, they go and they do all those gross joint compound fracture stuff with their, I've never seen someone catch a foot in midair with another foot and then lead it into like a figure four leg lock that snaps the guy's thigh joints, knee joints, and ankle joints simultaneously.
No, it's awesome. This whole fight, I mean, everything from this car chase all the way to the end is awesome.
Yeah. The Ed's favorite fight, the assassin fight. This is this guy that's wearing like this all black, like members only jacket type of outfit. And he's got these like sickle knives, these like, you know, there's like, these gut knives that he uses. When Rama gets those from him and he does I've seen the multi-stage major joint breakdowns before. This is the first time I've seen like Jim said that they did in the mud was just an hors d'oeuvre of what they're going to do here, because this is like every single major quadrant of the body, every limb is going to get those hooks from the joint to the fingertip or to the toe tip, from the scrot to the mouth, from the nipple to the belly button. This guy's going to get opened up.
Yeah. This is my favorite fight for a lot of reasons. First of all, the setting. It happens in this commercial kitchen where you have I mean, think of all the things in the kitchen. You have boiling oils, you have heavy pots and pans, you have sharp knives, you have glasses, bottles,
stainless steel table surfaces to slam things against.
Right, and marble countertops, and just like every hard edge, sharp implement you can think of is in this room. And they use a good portion of them.
And it's all insanely well lit. Like it's extremely, there's nothing to hide. Like it's all like super bright, fluorescent day glow lighting with gleaming white surfaces. It's
which blood looks great against. Let's just say that.
Yeah.
I was actually surprised at how reserved they were with the sharp implements and that kind of stuff. But it's a brutal fight. I mean, it's not brutal in like that it's crazy bloody, although it gets there at the end.
At the
end, just,
yeah.
It's like that Daredevil fight scene in the hallway where it's just knocked down, drag out. These guys go at each other for 10 minutes.
Fighting to exhaustion.
Yeah. I will say there's one thing I don't like about this fight, and it's where this guy grabs Rama's leg, holds it up in the air, takes one of these knives, and just cuts his knee tendons. Mm-hmm. And he limps for a second, but then he's right back to full fighting status. The wound is too egregious there. Like, that leg is not usable physically. I don't care how pain tolerant or how much endurance or willpower you have, your leg just can't move anymore. It doesn't have tendons.
It's structurally not sound. And in fact, there's the end of the assassin fight's even worse, because every single time Rama does this shit to a limb, he still continues to use the limb. The only thing that takes him down is like the torso shots that he gets to. He should have been
The neck.
Like the fucking Black Knight in Monty Python's Holy Grail, like after the first two passes with that curved blade, because he's just, like you can't stand on those legs, you can't throw punches.
Yeah,
you're gonna be a quivering mass of meat.
But ultimately, like, I don't care that much. Like, this fight is just all the way brutal, and it's really impressive. These are both two very skilled martial artists. It just and the choreography. I haven't mentioned like the choreography in this.
Yeah. How smooth it all is.
It's smooth. It's intricate. Like you said, with like hooking people's feet with your feet and spinning them around. It's kind of amazing. It feels like a martial arts dance in the best way that these films do, right?
They also do a very good job of hiding the... Because, you know, back in the 80s when you'd have like these martial arts films, you'd have like one guy in a ring of 30 dudes and they'd, you know, come at you one at a time. And you could tell that... They do a very good job of hiding with like the camera spins and the staging where it looks like people are attacking all the time, even though they're not.
Mm-hmm.
The only place where the seams you can kind of see is like that car fight, because it's such a small stage. You can definitely tell the guys in the backseat are kind of taking their turns attacking him. And they pan away from the camera and do this. But like, but I thought they did a really good job in this thing where everything they're trying to kill each other, and it doesn't look staged. Mm-hmm. It doesn't look like it. No. Looks like it's like flowing and fluid and
all that stuff with the wide shots I was talking about and the camera just showing you everything is never more evident than here. It's just two dudes going at each other, and one's going to come out alive and the other isn't, and the other's going to come out barely alive.
So Rama kills the guy, he takes him apart like a chicken, and then he busts out of the kitchen and he fish hooks this one dude where he just takes that curved knife, puts it right in his cheek and rips out. It's insane. Yep. At this point, the mob boss son and the other upstart have turned against each other because the kid saw a tattoo, the same tattoo that was on the mud fighters. And he's like, I'm being puppeted. I finally got my head out of my ass. And Rama gets a shotgun blast. It's like off center, but it kind of hits him all in his side. And I'm like, well, he's done. Gotta be. No, he's not. No. He's not. It's a glancing blow. But like, that's the first time where I'm like, I don't know. Other than, I guess he said, the time where the dude like slit his Achilles tendon and he's still jumping and kicking and stuff. But
sure. But man, some more brutal stuff in this scene. That shotgun to the face of Bejo is full grisly.
Not a glancing blow, that one.
Nope. And then I really like, you know, he has taken so much damage here. I like him stumbling out of this building, and he's kind of doing it at the same time that the internal affairs officer, whoever, is racing there to save him. Although I don't know that he can actually save him in this scenario, because it feels like he's defeated. You know, it's Rama walks down, back out the way he came, all these bodies, and he ends up in the warehouse. And the son of Godo, am I supposed to read that? The son of Godo shows up with like 50 dudes.
Yeah.
And I don't necessarily think they're there to kill him, but it's interesting how they play this, because he stands in front of them, broken. I don't think he can fight anymore. And there's an exchange that happens, but it's silent. They don't give you the audio and they don't give you subtitles for it. But the Japanese guy says something and he says a couple of things back. And then the one thing they leave you with audibly is he says, "No, I'm done." What is going on there?
It seems the consensus is that this Godo son is trying to hire him, which would enable him to continue his investigation and go another higher level, but he's like, "Nah, I'm done." But it also sets the stage for a third one, I suppose. It doesn't seem like we're going to get one. It's been 10 years.
Yeah, Garrett said he has just basic ideas in his head, and it feels like the time has passed for that, so probably not anytime soon, if ever.
Yeah, so that's what I'm saying. It's like, this is not The Godfather 2. This is not, it's also not like, you know, it's Star Wars sequels. It's not terrible. It's slightly not as good as the first one, because I hate to fall to something for excess, because it wasn't as fun of a first watch, but like, if you just want to go and like fast forward through all the plot parts and just the set pieces, they're incredible and they're lengthy and they don't repeat. Like, that's why I was like, well, 2.5 hours, I'm going to start getting bored with the fighting. And they do enough with the difference in set and weapons and skills and size and brutality. I just wish they had better emotional stakes. I think that third act would have played out a hell of a lot better if they had spent more time, instead of building up the weird stringy haired assassin, if they'd spent more time with like Rama and his family and building that relationship, so that you could really be worried about Rama walking out of there. But again, it's got some of the sickest action I've ever seen. So.
Oh yeah, no slouch in the action department.
The other way they could have gone is like the Commando direction, where they just go a little bit and make it funnier.
Sure.
You know, but
yeah,
then
put
just
Bejo in a mesh shirt instead of a suit.
Yeah. just, you know, have Rama go home for like a month before he goes into prison, or he's, you know, swimming and getting ice cream and petting deers with his son. Or yeah, they could have done a little something to give it a little bit more heart, because that's what this thing is missing that I thought the first one had, especially because the first one is just like, again, it's like 80, 90 minutes long, you know?
Mm-hmm.
They don't have enough time to have you kind of like checking your watch and tapping your toe, but glad I finally
overall
got to see these two.
Very good. I enjoyed it quite a bit. So.
Best 4 hours of action you can probably see on a concentrated basis.
Oh, that's a big claim. I'd have to think about that. It's a lot of John Wick
just
out
action.
There.
Just action. Yeah. But yeah, here's the other thing is like, John Wick 2 and 3, not so concentrated, the action.
Yeah.
A little samey. Gets a little samey, I think. I think one is awesome. And there's good stuff. Like, I really like the museum fight in the second one.
Oh, God.
The dog fight in the third one.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think John Wick got a little samey in 2 and 3. But yeah, if you're an action junkie, highly recommend these films. And yeah, anything else that this Eco Uwais has been in, Marantu, The Night Comes For Us, I guess that's on Netflix right now, and the Netflix series Wu Assassins. If you're wanting to get a fix, check it out. Okay, I think we're done with this commission. Thank you, Ed, for pulling the trigger on this. Really appreciate it. Thanks for your patience for waiting on us as we complete the project. If you're like, I want to get Aaron and Jim to talk about my favorite thing, how do I do that? Go to support.baldmove.com, click commission. That's how you start the process. You pay your money, you pick your film, your TV show, your any two-ish hours of content. We'll take it from there, contact you, handle all the details, make sure you love your podcast. Ed, we hope you loved yours. We'll see you on the next one in the future. I'm not sure what it is. These are commissions. I don't even know. This is going to probably come out 4 or 5 weeks after we record it. We'll see you on the next action pulp bald move movie podcast thing. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See you, folks.